And I am fighting for my son, of course. But it is bigger than Ross and bigger than a website. I think one website is by far less dangerous than the government trampling on our rule of law and the Constitution. I think that is very alarming. And to see it up close and personal the way I am makes it very real.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today I'm talking with Lynn Ulbricht. She is the mother of Ross Ulbricht, who is the defendant known as Dread Pirate Roberts, the alleged proprietor of Silk Road. He is going on trial in November for what could be one of the most important trials, certainly of the web and certainly of this year. He is charged with narcotics trafficking, computer hacking, money laundering, running a continuing criminal enterprise. Lynn, thanks for talking to us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Your son has pleaded not guilty on all charges?
That's correct.
Would you say you believe completely in his innocence, that he is not Dread Pirate Roberts?
I do. I believe in Ross. He's a man of his word, and I do believe in him.
In a way, obviously, you're going to be predisposed to believing in your son and believing his innocence. But one of the reasons we're talking with you is because you've become an outspoken advocate of why this trial matters to people who don't know Ross Ulbricht, to people who never used Silk Road, who have never bought legally or illegally pot or any other kind of drug. Let's talk a little bit about this and some of the arguments that you and your Ross's lawyers, who are Joshua Drittel and Lindsay Lewis, have talked about. This matters because you believe it opens the door for the censure of a free internet. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. The prosecution relies very heavily on something called transferred intent. And basically what that does is makes one person responsible for the intention and actions of another person. And in this case, its website host is responsible and in conspiracy with the users of the site and the ultimate user of the product, I believe. Just by the fact that they are on the site. And Forbes, Eric Goldman recently wrote about this in Forbes, and he said this is going to put a chill on the internet, because how can a website host know what's every single thing that's going on a site? And a lot of them do kind of know that there's illegitimate stuff going on.
So this is kind of like if you're running a site, there's a bunch of people start swapping, prostitution services or something. As it stands now, for the most part, if you're the web host and you're not specifically party to that, you can't be charged with criminal activity.
Correct. That's under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. So that's like if you as an individual took one of them to court in civil court, they would be immune. However, if the federal government took them to court in criminal court, they would have no protections whatsoever, which Joshua Drittel says creates a dangerous anomaly and opens a crack in the door for precedent to be set here. Because if Ross were convicted, he'd be the first website host ever to be convicted for the actions of the users of the site. And the federal government said in their responses to the motions, our laws are expansive and adaptable, especially when it comes to the internet.
Of course, where does that come from? The idea that the internet is somehow a looser place for law enforcement than meat space?
Well, exactly. And the Supreme Court just made it clear that it is not, that the digital information falls under the protections of the Constitution just like anything else in the Riley versus California case. Which takes us into illegal searches and seizures.
Talk a bit more about transferred intent and how that's playing out with Federal Express as well.
Yeah, the Federal Express was recently indicted for drug trafficking because they're holding them responsible for people using their service to transport illegal prescription drugs.
So the idea here, the idea to bring it back to the notion that this case matters because it opens the door to a kind of censuring of the market on the internet, but also a chilling effect, is that suddenly if you're a web host and you can be held responsible for things people are doing or saying on your website, you're in big trouble.
Well, I mean, it's not only me saying it. Eric Goldman in his Forbes article said, why would someone take the chance? It's one thing to risk your money. It's another thing to risk your freedom. And it's not even an excuse to say, oh, I didn't know it was going on, because you're supposed to know what's going on, according to the government.
And to be fair, though, Silk Road was positing itself. It was selling itself as a marketplace of illicit and, oftentimes either gray market or black market goods and services.
Well, from what I understand, and I didn't go on it, I don't know that much about it really, is that it initially was an anonymous marketplace that was consumer directed. Mm-hmm. But yes, of course, there were illicit things on there. So, but the point is, it's the principle involved and mm-hmm. the precedent that will be set.
Right.
So I'm not here to defend Silk Road at all, or drug use or anything. Mm-hmm. But what our lawyers are saying is that this opens up a dangerous little crack in the door. And well, they're doing it with FedEx. I don't think anybody thinks FedEx is, you know,
is
a drug
really
marketplace.
In it for the drug trade. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Another reason why you say the case matters is that vague allegation, you know, that it's built on vague allegations that don't cite specific crimes. And so that violates the Fifth and Sixth Amendments. Talk a little bit about how that plays out in this case.
Right. They speak in very sweeping generalities in the indictment, which is not in constitution, directly in opposition to the Fifth Amendment and due process, which says allegations must be specific. And they talk about others known and unknown, a series of violations, or malicious software, certain narcotics laws, without naming a specific one. This is void for vagueness, according to the courts. This means you have to cite specific allegations. Otherwise, these allegations, how do you defend yourself against something vague?
Mm-hmm. And this goes, is the government making the case that, oh, well, because this is internet-based, we don't have to be quite as exact? Or do you think it's just sloppy prosecution?
Well, actually, our lawyers did try to get some specifics out of them informally before the motions, and what they got back was an email saying, you have all the specifics you need. That was all the explanation they gave. They didn't say why.
Following up on that and in a slightly different but related way, there are Fourth Amendment concerns that are raised here about also kind of detailing, giving actual detailed specific understandings of where certain types of evidence comes from and how it was found.
Right.
Just recently, your lawyer, the lawyers for Ross, put in motions about the Fourth Amendment, saying that all of this evidence should be, you know, basically taken out. Talk a little bit about that.
Okay, sure. First of all, they have not said how they found the Silk Road server, what methods they used. This is required. And if you don't say how, then how do you even know the evidence wasn't fabricated? I mean, or that's my question. So they need, the motions are saying, you need to tell us how you found the server. If they, and
the
they
server,
did not have a warrant
we,
for it.
We don't know for sure, but it's widely believed that the server was in a foreign country somewhere.
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. I believe Iceland.
Right.
So then there's the question, did you need a warrant? There's precedent for that in the Microsoft case where the government had a warrant and was able to go to a foreign server and get the information. But from what I understand, it's still required by the Fourth Amendment to have a warrant.
So basically, part of the argument then is that if the server was in a foreign country and the government somehow got into, they got it and were able to mirror it or basically take everything off it, that, you know, where is the warrant for that, or under what circumstances did they get that information?
Exactly. If it was procured illegally, then all the evidence deriving from that is inadmissible.
And that's pretty much, one would assume that's the case right there.
It could be.
Yeah.
But there's also other violations. For instance, there's 14 searches and seizures in this case, and there's more than one that have no warrant. But the other issue is a warrant needs to be specific, as we were talking about, and it needs to be satisfy probable cause, the reason, a legitimate reason to go after it. Here, they're what are called general warrants, where it's a fishing expedition through all your property. And this is unlimited rummaging through everything, hoping to find something. This is the same kind of warrant that we had the American Revolution over, that Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense about.
Right.
It's to violate this, to violate the Fourth Amendment, weakens all of our protections.
Right.
And that's why I think this is a much bigger case than just Ross.
One of the concerns that the defense has is that the NSA was pursuing a kind of parallel construction. Explain what parallel construction is and why it raises real concerns.
From what I understand, parallel construction relies on information that is procured by the NSA illegally, so it can't be revealed, and then they construct an investigation that's not real, but is an explanation of how they found the target that is not actually how they found it.
So that would be something like the NSA goes, you know, finds a server in Iceland or whatever, or they, you know, the DEA or some other federal law enforcement agency gets information from the NSA, and then they create a false story that would put it within the realm of a legal kind of investigation.
Yeah, old-fashioned detective work
versus... Okay. And I guess it's also, this goes back to that question of the government kind of trying to treat the internet differently than, you know, kind of established real, you know, real empirical reality, is the idea that if they, you know, because there's no there, they can be everywhere without following the same kind of judicial processes.
Well, the Supreme Court has proven that they do not agree. You know, recently with Riley versus California with an illegal search of a cell phone.
Yeah. So one of the other things that you talk about the case mattering about is that, you know, in this and in through all of the discussion and the discourse around it, the government and many people in the media who talk about it or whatnot, you know, the government is equating interest in like a desire for privacy with criminal intent. Talk a little bit about that and why that matters.
Well, from what I understand, in their response to the motions, they said that if you use Tor, for example, you
which
must
is short
have criminal...
for the Onion Router, and it's a an encrypted web serving process or online communications process that was actually partly developed by the government to help dissidents in repressive regimes. So it's ironic that you know, if you're using Tor now, you're immediately suspect of doing something wrong.
Exactly. And so it's really saying that wanting privacy, that you don't have a right, maybe there's lots of reasons why you might want privacy. And so that seems to me, it's again, expansive as far as what they are doing here.
This appears to be a case where the federal government is trying to expand money laundering, or this would be the first place where they would be able to kind of extend money laundering crimes or criminal statutes to digital currency. Because there's a lot of Bitcoin involved here, and your son was found or is alleged to have had hundreds of Bitcoins, which his lawyer has actually also asked for back. How does expanding money laundering statutes to digital currency, you know, why should that worry us?
Well, I guess it depends on what the definition of money is, and that's this big fight the government's having with itself.
And by that, you mean earlier this year, the IRS actually ruled that Bitcoin is not money.
It's property.
It's property, and so can be taxed. It's more like stocks, which you can own, but then you get taxed on the appreciated value.
Right. Yeah. And FinCEN said it's not legal tender in any jurisdiction. But then the prosecution, what to me is concerning about what they're saying is everything should be funds. Forget digital currency. Everything. Barter. You know, at Porkfest, people were trading eggs for, someone made the point that we're trading eggs for whatever and bread. Is that funds?
No.
Any exchangeable property. Well, of course, this expands the money laundering liability of people and creates a whole bunch more criminals, just like a whole new class of criminals with website hosts. Is this a new class of criminal now, a website host, if someone does something on their site that... is illegitimate.
He was also charged originally, or not charged, but among the things that were brought to bear was with setting up or conspiring to commit six murders. Can you talk a little bit about that and the role that that charge, which is not what he's on trial now for, how did that play into the way that he's been treated by the federal government?
Correct. At his bail hearing, the federal government used those murder for hire allegations to deny him bail. Saying he was dangerous, which, if you knew Ross, is the most absurd allegation ever. And so then, 2.5 months later, Sarah Turner, the prosecutor, did not indict him for one single murder-for-hire charge, even though he used it to deny him bail. So there were six murder-for-hire charges.
And this is when he was picked up, or he was arrested last October in 2013.
Correct.
That was part of the story, is that he had been a kind of genial computer hacker or programmer, kind of layabout, nice guy who had transformed himself into this sinister dark net, dark web, Silk Road operator who was running an operation that in 2013 had something like $1.2 billion in illicit trade going on. And that he was hiring people to kill people he thought were threats to his empire.
Yeah, they didn't indict him for that in New York, who is in charge of the case right now. So 5 out of 6 of those charges are now uncharged crime, which does not require proof. And actually, the recent motions are saying these need to be taken out of here. They're a mention and they're prejudicial to the jury. There is a final 6th one that is in Maryland that's just kind of been there since October. I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. Frankly, I don't know. It's just sitting there.
In a long New York Times Magazine story earlier this year, Ross was described, among other things. The title was Eagle Scout, Idealist, Drug Trafficker, ? He was described, among other things, as a ardent libertarian. What are or what were his political beliefs? Do you share them, and where did they arise from?
Yeah. Well, and that brings up a First Amendment issue in the indictment, actually, because they are going, and it's brought up in the motions, is they're going back pre-Silk Road to his Facebook and other postings and using his political and economic views against him, which I think implicates the First Amendment. You know, I don't know, I can't really speak to that very well. I mean, I know that he's written about it and that he was interested in the Von Mises Institute. And as you know, so that's, you know.
What about yourself and your husband and your family? I mean, dealing with this, how has this affected your, you know, your kind of belief in government institutions and the ability of, you know, of the courts to act fairly and, and wisely?
Well, you know, I am a believer in the Constitution. I think it's a, you know, inspired document, and it's very disturbing to me to see it abused. And I think that that's what's happening here. I feel like the Bill of Rights is on trial as much as Ross is, and it's very concerning. But actually, that concern kind of fuels my energy because, and I am fighting for my son, of course, but it is bigger than Ross and bigger than a website. I think one website is by far less dangerous than the government trampling on our rule of law and the Constitution. I think that is very alarming. And to see it up close and personal the way I am makes it very real. And I think it's, despite, I think the defendant and the allegations in this case are secondary. I know they're controversial. Much of it cannot be defended in terms of, you know, people's morality or whatever. But it's, what's really important here and what's dangerous here is how the government is operating. And that is something that I've really opened my eyes to.
How do you feel that the treatment of the story and of your story and of your son's story has been in the media so far? I mean, you've talked about Forbes has done a lot of sympathetic coverage and coverage that's sensitive to many of the issues raised. The New York Times Magazine story really seemed to, you know, come down very heavily on the idea that the feds had gotten their man and that your son had become this, you know, Dread Pirate Roberts. How important is the media coverage, and where do you see it falling?
Well, yeah, I mean, sensationalistic coverage, I guess, sells more copies. I would say that the majority or many are disappointing for, to me. They just have tried and convicted Ross already. They don't use alleged, as you very kindly did and responsibly. They and I sometimes will tweet them or message, say, hey, how about using alleged? He has not been convicted. We have a presumption of innocence in this country, and it's hurt. It's hurt his reputation, and it certainly has suppressed fundraising. I understand people's reaction to it. The fact that they have not indicted him for it, why not? If you have the evidence, why not? And that to me, but the media doesn't really talk about it that much.
The trial is going to last 4 to 6 weeks by the estimates I've read. You know, does that sound about right to you? And what is, you know, what's the worst outcome that can happen? What kind of sentencing is Ross facing if he's found guilty on all charges?
Right. Time frame is, again, estimated. It sounds about right. He's facing what would add up to be his life. There's mandatory minimums, which we can talk about those sometime, but add it all up and, you know, he's facing draconian consequences.
How is he holding up through all of this? Because he's been in prison now for, jail for 10 months, so.
Ross is a very strong person. He's very resilient, and he does have a big picture outlook on things, and he's holding up as well as can be expected, I would say. people have commented, you know, probably better than most. Mm-hmm. He tries to keep a positive attitude, be a good force in the prison. He was conducting a physics class, a yoga class. He is a very positive person. However, it is very challenging. Now he's working on discovery when he's allowed to have access to it, and that's very grueling under difficult circumstances. But he's persevering.
Where are the most interesting allies that you've found in kind of talking about the larger issues of the cases? And then are there any people who you would have expected to be, you know, reaching out or being allies in this who have just disappointed you?
Well, we've had a lot of anonymous donors through Bitcoin, which would be expected. Roger Ver came out with a retweet campaign that was very supportive and very helpful, where he's going to be donating a substantial amount to our fund over time.
Explain who he is.
Well, I guess he's the Bitcoin Jesus.
Yeah.
Bitcoin evangelist and angel investor and a major figure in the Bitcoin world. Mm-hmm. But he's been supportive, and there's been other people who care about freedom and the larger issues here beyond the details. Mm-hmm. And
the Electronic Frontier Foundation has been supportive. Is that right?
They have. I mean, from the beginning, I talked to people there who helped us find Joshua Dreitel, and he's conferred with them. Mm-hmm. A lot, and yes, they are supportive.
Where is the best place to for more information on the case? Where should people go?
Yeah, we have a website, freeross.org, and it has information on the case, ways to donate, ways to contact us. We definitely need help with donations, as well as, you know, information, advice, contacts, all that kind of thing. We're small. We're fighting a big fight, and we really need help.
Well, we will leave it there. Thank you, Lynn Ulbricht. Lynn Ulbricht is the mother of Ross Ulbricht, who is facing trial in November on charges of running Silk Road and being Dread Pirate Roberts. The outcome will affect him. If he's found guilty on all of the charges, it's an effective life sentence, and it may well affect the outcome of the internet and the ways in which we deal with things in cyberspace. For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.